The moments of stark blue skies during last week had congealed into thickly hanging baskets of rain. The underside of these rain, mist and mizzle carrioles brushed our shoulders as Gillian and I walked up the sheep trails of Wideford Hill. Gillian's fierce pale face and her endless supplies of thickly woven mittens had become a familiar friend, and we had taken to wandering and talking every other day, even if it was just across the road to Stenness. It was through Gillian that I heard a history of Sand 14, how Richard had been convinced that the landscapes of Orkney could achieve what he felt he had failed at running a business near London, how George's industrial paintings and sculptures had become involved, although less so now. We walked up a wide road in the heather to the summit of the hill, dominated by a vast mobile phone antenna, dull steel scaffold at one with the clouds hanging low, brushing at its crenulations. This was one of the highest points on mainland, and looked out over a wide vista of fields, moors, and waters. We looked back, and the mobile phone handsets on the island looked back, I knew, with their stuttering regularity. "We designed a cooperatively owned one of these," said Gillian, looking up with faint disapproval at the corporate steel behemoth above our heads. "Really?" "Yes, a couple of years ago, for one of those big European-funded projects in renewable energy." She clapped her mauve mittened hands together, seal-like, stretching her arms. "Oh, it was great! We even got some award." The collection of base station huts and barbed wire, some mimicking barrows beneath earthen mounds, drifted from our attention, and Gillian began to lead me down the hill in a different direction. Rain settled in my hair briefly, and then lifted, too languid to fall. "It was a combined mobile phone antenna and wind turbine, one powered by the other. Well, we did the social design, as Richard pitched it. And did, gosh, months of ethnography on Bursay. They have a cooperatively owned wind turbine there and sell their excess power back to the national grid. Well, naturally, we worked with them to construct a cooperatively owned and maintained wind-powered antenna as part of a franchise system from the mobile operator. Sorted out all the bureaucracy with Ofcom, created this fabulous little pack of all the relationships that needed to be taken care of, both with maintenance companies and inside the co-op. That was my part. I did all the pack design, gave it a little box, fold-outs, tried to cut out the worst of the printer inks. It was great." "Wow." I was genuinely impressed. It seemed like such a great idea, in principle at least. "The proposal offered the advantage of combining the provision of two utilities, electrical and telephony, and it provided a community with the ownership of something like that tower up there, which has a pretty substantial impact on their local environment and landscape. You know, the mobile industry has had terrible trouble in some places installing antennas. We hope that this would help everyone." She glanced at me, raindrops a net over her fist of orange hair. "Although none of the operators have taken it up yet." She turned back, pointed down the hill. "Don't think you've been there yet," she said. I followed the line of her mitten to an area of grass, but could not make out any structure. No banks, ditches. Wondered if it was some subtle mark in the heather, barely discernible. I almost walked on top of it. Gillian pulled back a large iron-green lid buried into the surface of the hill. Inside the black opening was a small notice politely offering us a torch on a hook and a suggestion that we take care on the damp metal ladder within. We climbed downwards out of the rain. Inside the hill was a passage grave, stone rooms with tall corbelled roofs and floors of sandstone mud. Pools of copper water connected by tiny openings in the wall that we could only squeeze through. Gillian loved rock. Aside from her embroidery and knitting business, which she ran in addition to working at Sand 14, she was a magpie for interesting little pieces of stone and rock. On long evenings at her home, we had sat on cushions amongst her tiers of rocks, and she had relayed stories of all of them. Now she was idly feeling along the joins in the rock walls, eyes half closed, touching rather than seeing. "I've tried to get Simon to use his force feedback stuff on the Cameraphone project," she said unexpectedly, in the way of someone connecting and reconnecting thoughts. "It seems a shame that it's such a struggle, that project," I said. "Oh, I know. I think what Simon did needs a name. Anne was so adamant that this was about storytelling, and in all good stories, naming things gives them life, gives them power and a shape." She opened her eyes, smiled slightly apologetic. "When you're sewing or knitting, you have to know what you're making right at the outset. It's just impossible. You can't make it up as you go." "You need a pattern," I volunteered. "Yes, that's right," she agreed. "Even if you embellish or change it out of all recognition." We returned to Sand 14 later that morning feeling expanded, that reorientation of the shoulder blades lower, wider. The concentrated squint of forehead and eye pits gone for a while. Everyone was in, and the studio buzzed with conversation and quiet music. Gillian decided to work on her chaise long for a while, and Dan helped her quickly rig up the power and network connections she needed from the overhead gantry. George had been the source of this office design. The idea was that anyone could set up their desk anywhere they liked, with whatever furniture they liked, although some negotiation with one's colleagues was always necessary. George had been adamant that this was not hot desking, which he waved away as some awful 1980s downsizing utopia. Just dreadful. It never works. People need to choose their own space, not be foisted with one. I certainly do. Although I had noticed that the egalitarianism was occasionally outweighed by George's own aesthetic judgment, since she had purchased much of the original furniture from IKEA, and her opinion of Simon's old filing cupboard by the window was legend. She was the one who had provided it with some hospital wheels. Lunch was early. A homemade soup and crusty bread from George as something of a celebratory experience. She was one of those people who was unfazed by feeding double figures at short notice. It was only a few times a month that everyone was in and could squeeze in around the kitchen table together. Gillian playfully erected a little decorative tableau in the centre from one of the plastic models of the carved stone ball that Simon had been working with, surrounding it with a gravel of stones and a couple of candles. As Simon loaded china and cutlery into the dishwasher with his usual hyperactive verve, the conversation returned to the question of the Cameraphone project. "I think we should go back to the attic," suggested George, her face wrinkled in thought. She tugged at the red scarf around her neck. "We've talked about nostalgia, about things lasting for generations, creating something that both your grandchildren and grandparents can enjoy. So what happens in the attic? You just chuck stuff up there, I know I do. Attics are where you store your memories, like those old family photograph albums." Gillian laughed. "I think my attic has spread downwards into my house." She paused, hand on sharp chin for a moment, then added, "You know, I don't just chuck stuff up there. I do make some effort to pack it, put it into a box." "I label all my boxes," said Dan, eyes wide over sips of tea. You're just too well organised, Gillian jibed. I keep my postcards on the fridge, noted Anne. After a few weeks, I throw them out. Well, I think I have a couple hiding somewhere in a drawer, but from everyone I talk to, almost no one keeps all their postcards. Whereas they do keep all their photos, except that now, with digital photos, people are starting to delete them again. She leaned over for the teapot, offered more tea, and then filled her own mug. I keep them as souvenirs, said Gillian. I suppose it's like paperweights. So you're saying we need to create a pointless make-weight that maybe has a pretty picture in it and can happily collect dust on the mantelpiece, said Simon, pulling up his chair again to the table, sketch pad, notes, and pens resurging from their former place on the floor. Ah, Anne put down her mug. Snow globes! Her merry face broke into a twinkling smile. I was not sure if she was serious or not. Simon was with her, energetic. Now you're talking, Anne. It's a 3D postcard. He glanced conspiratorially at Dan. You pick it up and shake it every now and again or whatever to view it. Perhaps it's kinetically powered. From her high back chair, George looked at everyone over the dark rim of her glasses, mock stern. You know, I can honestly say I have never and will never own a snow globe. They are absolutely ghastly tat. I can't imagine us ever creating anything so naff. She peered at Anne from the steely business end of the kitchen. Are you serious? Oh, not really, but it does translate well. All objects carry a story, of course, which you don't need to have written down, may have nothing to do with its history. You don't re-experience anything, you retell the story of it to someone. And quite what that has to do with what happened. Well, you tell the story any way you want to, don't you? She gathered her cardigan around her large figure and sat back in her chair. Kitsch or art, they all have their adherents. Su Yin reminded the room in her quiet voice, looking around intently. What about Venetian glass paperweights? Absolutely, agreed George. Thank you. I think I can handle Venetian glass. People are magpies. They want shininess, added Gillian, raising her eyebrows at me. It's got to look more like a Montblanc fountain pen, whereas other camera devices look more high-tech. Anne was always pushing away from the industry's technology, pushing to other artifacts. We need to make something that everyone can have in their hands. We need something that the industry can play with as much as the rest of us, said Simon, being pragmatic. A mobile-enabled snow globe, murmured Dan, smirking. Well, at least we're not starting with the technology, said Simon, doodling schematics on a sheet of paper. Even Babbage managed to prototype the computer without starting with the idea for the transistor. He glanced at Dan, the programmer, who carried on blandly sipping his tea. Gillian picked up the sandstone model, holding up one of its six sides to eye. So how do you get the image in there, then? How do you take the picture? She asked. Cameras are as small as dice, explained Simon, sketching broadly as he spoke. You just put one into the end, press a button, then hey presto, the picture appears in your snow globe. We need something other than a snow globe. Anything has got to be better than a snow globe, for goodness sake. George was adamant. We need a name. Gillian looked around her. Anne agreed, and offered to make a space on the studio wall for everyone's ideas. Does anyone have any ideas now? She asked. There was a long period of silence, everyone looking around, seeing if someone had an answer. Simon pushed away from the table, leaned back. We have some time before delivery, he said. And as if this provided an escape from the topic, the conversation moved on to other things. Later, on one of the walls of the studio, on a vast white-painted pinboard, a page with a photograph of Simon's makeshift camera and stone demo appeared. And below, slowly gathered a list of possible names for the artifact, with people adding a vote and their comments, as well as other suggestions. The list ran to obvious variations on globe, core, ball, world, and less obvious local references such as the Comet Stone, an outlying standing stone at the Ring of Brodgar. By the end of a week of pencil scribbling, the top two scoring favourites were Eyeball, which seemed to provide much hilarity, although sober reflection in George's inimitable style and calligraphy read, To Apple. And the second favourite was the Camera Stone, for its obvious resonance with camera-phone, and as possibly Simon had written, it does what it says. The next time the group got together, the name seemed to have had an effect. There was a pattern of activity. Su Yin, as a resident industrial designer, had begun a series of sketches based on one particular carved stone ball, pictured in various locations from various positions, in the hands, to collecting dust in the attic, sitting on a mantelpiece, and even being held up by a walker on the top of a mountain at sunset. That's the product glory shot, she explained. On pride of place on her thin glass desk were two balls. One was the almost spherical globe covered in spirals of scratches which Simon had first picked up. The other was a ball of plastic with nodules reminiscent of the model of a prickly blue granite carved stone ball I had seen in the box from the education centre. It was quite difficult, Su Yin was saying, talking of her preliminary 3D CAD model. The model I was originally using was a ball with four sides, and it felt very strange. It was quite trans-dimensional. I expected it to have six sides like a cube, like the original model that you played with. She showed me the original photographs and the first CAD model with the dark holes for cameras and eyepieces. I noticed that on her glass desk surface she had a large piece of pumice propping up a memory stick. It's from an old volcano in Malaysia, she explained. Gillian had also been busy working on various pouches for the device, in padded felt, neoprene, wool, and even some kind of Gore-Tex equivalent. They varied from what looked like spherical camera cases to elaborate evening purses with a metal clasp. Between Gillian, Anne, and Simon, they had also begun to explore the point of sale and everyday use of the object, taking pictures of the sales racks for computing, mobile phone, and hi-fi and electrical items, and overlaying images of the ball. Anne, in particular, was worried that it didn't fit into a mobile phone shop. It's decorative. It's ornamental. It should be in a glass case in the jewellery section, more like a watch than a mobile, she said. Even Swatch watches are displayed in a glass case. George was unconvinced by the whole concept, however. You can't see what's inside, though, she worried. It's going to have to be pretty gorgeous by itself. Ah, but it's a private space, said Simon. It's an intimate space which only you, or those close to you, through one of the windows has access. Simon was clearly enamoured with the whole concept. George was immediately critical, pushing up her glasses onto the top of her head. I'm not sure I like that. It's bad enough with all these camera phones everywhere secretly filming. Anne quickly interjected. But this is designed to be conspicuous. It's not masquerading as anything else. In that respect, it's much more like a camera, a distinctive object, rather than a camera in the shape of a mobile phone. George was clearly still needing some persuasion. How does it broadcast? I hate being all industrial, I just hate it. But that's who we've got to convince. We have to come up with a mass market broadcast device. Anne, I think that's your area. She turned to stare hard at Anne. Oh, no bother. Anne was unconcerned, waving away George's stare. We've got a wee demo started, then continued. The industry wants something that's seamless and straightforward, so we're keeping well away from the radio. Simon swept in. Yeah, we're radio agnostic. George gave him a levelling look. She rarely let marketing jargon pass, and he amended, being more specific. Well, we're assuming that anyone who wants one of these already has either a computer with USB or a mobile with Bluetooth. The first enables only internet broadcast, admittedly, but the latter is all about mobile broadcast, even on GSM. It's a card-carrying fixed mobile convergence device. He ended with a cocky grin. George considered for a moment, then nodded. Okay, I think that almost makes it mass market, but there's two questions. One, my ageing mother. What about her? She is the biggest collector of family souvenirs and postcards on her mantelpiece, I can tell you. George held up one of Su Yin's intricate, bold sketches, thoughtful, her eyes darting, absorbing the image critically as an artist. Fabulous, she commented with admiration to Su Yin. I love that quartz texture you're using. It looks sensational. Stone is more natural than white, explained Su Yin. It's ageless, is an illusion. Like Roman architecture, it's the shadows you see. And stone has a memory, interjected Anne. George nodded but drew a long breath, scratched her chin absently, and continued with her concerns. And the second question, she said, is why anyone would use expensive mobile instead of cheap internet to broadcast. It will be the first criticism anyone from the industry will make. I do like where this is going, I do like it, but you have to be pragmatic. It's tedious, I know. She sighed and stood, headed over to the espresso machine by the sink and took orders for coffee. There was quiet for a moment, only the putt-putt of the boiler in the espresso machine. Anne, Simon and Su Yin exchanged glances. Then Anne said, with laughter in her voice, "Oh, we've gone and created a mobile viewmaster." "Then it will make the cover of T3 or stuff," said Simon, sounding frustrated. "It's a toy and a gadget, everything those early adopters and gadget freaks crave." He slapped down a copy of the magazine he had been thumbing through with some disgust. It was full of yellow post-it notes and green sticky labels. Su Yin gave him a quizzical look. I think that is what we are trying to avoid. Over the next week, Anne was out of the office, having cake with George's mother, apparently. But I caught up with her the following Monday and asked about the project. She explained that their approach was always the design of a socio-technical system. The technical design of the product was always integrated into a social design for its use. "Oh, I'm not saying that you can determine what people will do," she said. "People always surprise me. A lady the other day, Pam on South Ronaldsey, she thought it would be a bottled garden. She imagined the ball like some miniature geodesic greenhouse for growing exotic plants." She laughed warmly. "Imagine the telecoms industry selling its wares at garden centres." I smiled. I liked the idea of a mobile phone store next to the ornamental roses, but found it sadly unlikely. "But you can work with lots of people," she continued, "to understand what they might want to do with something, and design in all the systems, the social infrastructure as much as a network infrastructure." "I don't just mean user interface," she said hurriedly. "I mean all the broader social relationships which sustain the object in the everyday world. As far as we are concerned, you just can't have a product on a shelf that gets picked up and used. It's always integrated into a community and network of relationships. When we design something, we try to imagine all those everyday relationships as well. And I don't mean all that skin-deep, dreadful scenario stuff either. She sank into her own modest office chair and described their process for me, hand still, face carrying all her meaning. Su Yin and Simon work through something solid. Su Yin does the sketches and creates the CAD data, and Simon uses them to get a model made. With Dan, who's a software engineer, the three of them often build a software prototype, just something to fake a series of interactions. Then I just talk to people, in supermarkets, at the post office. I just talk and talk. Sometimes we give presentations to local societies. We run school competitions. Focus groups, I said, assuming. Oh, Lord, no, she shook her head. You just end up with a room full of politics. No, it's just everyday talk. Sometimes we do integrate the idea with a particular company or project somewhere, like we did with the wind-powered antenna on Bursay. I'm actually thinking of working with the Orkney Craft Trail on this one. Talk to a few tourists, since it's the season. It's the ornamental aspect I'm trying to get at. Anyway, everyone gets a hard time from me. Despite Anne's humour, she seemed to act as something of a linchpin. Her story of having cake with George's mother expanded when talking with her into one of a detailed ethnography, not just of people's postcards and souvenirs, but also their impressions and experiences of the camera stone. She had been off spending hours talking in depth with a whole host of different people about their old photograph albums, holiday knick-knacks, valuable souvenirs, about their mantelpieces, television tops, picture frames, fridges and attics. And she had left camera stone models with people all over the islands. She had also spent time conducting participant observation at Skara Brae, seeing how the coachloads of tourists collected their memories, and had attended a friend's wedding with a notebook. She had even been in cahoots with Amber to gather a report on how the nightclub and dance scene on the islands captured their memories of a good night out. I asked her how she reported her findings, and she explained that she kept her own extensive ethnographic archive of data, but otherwise, I just talk. I talk a lot, you know. I pressed the issue of recording, or at least publishing. Aye, in a quiet moment, I do publish in the odd academic journal, just to keep my hand in. But what would be the point of spending hours writing a report for Simon, and him spending hours reading it, when I can wander over to him and we can talk about it? I guess you could say I tend to rely on an oral tradition. There was a process to their development, but it seemed to remain largely undocumented. There was a strong resistance to paper auditing, perhaps an effect of a strong sense of time in the company. When you only have 4 hours of daylight, you tend to become a PD pragmatic in your use of time, explained Anne one day. We don't have time for PowerPoint, commented Simon at another juncture. What remained, what was made durable, was the empirical rather than the managerial. Anne kept a huge archive and database of all her notes and ethnographic materials. Similarly, Simon and Gillian each had their own archive of sketches, models, and drawings from previous projects, and little pet activities that each seemed to work on in odd moments. These archives, I found out, were kept in the small basement room accessed through the little trap door in the floor of the studio. They often referred to previous projects and conversation, using the object almost as a black box through which connections to the many ideas worked through might be accessed. The heritage of the project remained largely condensed into artifacts, whose biography was retold and remade at different moments in the service of new work. I asked Richard one day about the lack of paperwork, how the design studio functioned without financial projections, without regular accounts of the success or failure of the company in some numerical terms. He waved my questions away. "Oh, it's nothing secret. Everyone has access to the budgets. We have a weekly budget meeting on Monday mornings and haggle a little bit between ourselves, but that's about it. Kath handles front of house, makes sure it's all legally and financially holding water. Have you met her? We often do things because we want to." One of the effects of the locale on Orkney seemed to be a pronounced reliance on personal social relations, on a reciprocity both with the company and with others in the company. It was almost as if Sand 14 was itself a distinct island within the archipelago community. And as such, there was nothing romantic or idealised about the working practices. It placed extensive social demands on each person who needed to remain sensitive to their social obligations. It was a small community, and little went unnoticed. As time progressed, it became clear that projects also became people. The role of the prototypes which they built were almost to act as the socio-technical body to which everyone bonded, formed a reciprocal relation. Literally, as I watched the 4 weeks of intensive activity around the brief, I was watching a group of people fall in love with a socially and technologically designed object. Love suffused these islands, I thought, staring out through the semicircular window at the black head of a seal bobbing in the water. The next meeting in the kitchen was considerably more heated. They had yet to establish how to communicate their work back to industry, other than the usual PowerPoint slides and sleight-of-hand demo in a boardroom. Richard and Kath, a retired solicitor who acted as front, as everyone called it, began the conversation by saying that they had been oiling the possibility of a visitation by the client for the Camerastone project by offering special access to various monuments. Richard was leaning back precariously on two legs of his old chair, head back, thinking. "Well, I know they want to come. It's really rather a matter of if they get a reorg." He flashed a quick conspiratorial grin. If San 14 was predominantly an oral storytelling community, then I could well imagine why they wished their customers to visit and talk through the material with them, rather than package it up into a document and presentation which they would be expected to deliver in a formal meeting. Locations, rooms, and social structures, such as formal meetings, had enormous effects on the possibilities for what might be made present, and those things that might be made absent. Simon then demoed the first prototype, and between him and Anne talked through how it would work in practice. There was one prototype and what looked like a basic model. The prototype was a polished bronze globe with five gleaming rings of a protruding eyepiece, each surrounded by a delicate engraved spiral. The sixth side, uppermost, was a spirally decorated dial with an engraved marking around the edge. It was reminiscent of some Victorian machinery, more a child of Babbage than a child of the transistor. And I was not surprised to find that the pouch on which it rested, made by Gillian, was surfaced in black silk, a shroud of contemporary lace. Out of one of the apertures on which the object rested were a bundle of cables leading into a laptop under the programming gaze and fingers of Dan. I asked what was inside, and Simon shrugged. "Oh, just some small LCD screens, culled from a VR project we did way, way back." There was also a second model, designed to be handled, which resembled a rather dazzling opaque white marble, a ball of quartz, or more prosaically, a dirty snowball of a well-thumbed iPod. On five opposing sides were drawn a soft cornered square, through which extruded a creamy rubberized square of eyepiece. The upper thick side was a soft nodule of a dial. The model, too, had its own bag, a white, ribbon-edged pouch of neoprene. With its textures of protected rubber and toughened stone-like surface, it seemed built for mountains, for harsh weather. It seemed designed to endure. Su Yin opened up a huge portfolio file and showed page after page of binocular and telescope brochures and images, from ornate brass desk magnifiers to the flat metal bar of digital binoculars. She reminded everyone of various discussions and comments that had been made over the last weeks, her understated presence contrasting with the boldness of her work, so that the room became quiet, silent, listening. She had a whole collection of sketches and other variations of the camera stone, which Gillian then matched up with fabric samples and sketches of purses and carry cases. Then it was Dan and Simon who did a double act demonstrating the prototype, a wizard and glass affair of fake technical relations. There were two ways of using the camera stone to capture the world, as Simon called it. Firstly, the stone could be placed or held somewhere, the dial set for all, and all five cameras would take a concurrent snapshot or short movies. Simon suggested that lots of interesting effects might be possible if you moved the ball at the same time to create a sort of animation effect. Secondly, you could use the dial to select a single camera to take a shot or movie and build up a set of images. This was all hand-waving as far as I could see. Simon holding up the bronze stone to show that, when on single-shot mode, you use the opposing side as a viewfinder. Finally, they showed the different ways of manipulating the images. Firstly, and most obviously, the stone acted as an ornament that could store its set of images in flash memory, only needing a vigorous shake or some other personalized movement, as Simon put it, every week or so to keep them displayed. Anne said she would have quite a bit to say about that shortly. Then it was a Bluetooth device, so that by setting the dial, all the data was downloaded to a Bluetooth-enabled mobile phone. Here it was just an image on Dan's laptop. You could then engage any of the images or movies using whatever facilities the phone and network were capable of. It made multimedia content in the language of the industry. What was particularly interesting was Simon's suggestion that the camera stone could exchange worlds between themselves, one Bluetooth device to another. Your experience of the midsummer sunrise Stonehenge could become an underwater experience of the passing of a shoal of silverfish. Finally, the device had a mini USB port so that all the data could be downloaded to a piece of software on a computer, faked again by Dan, software which would help knit together the images into panoramas or collections for emailing out, or storing on an internet-based archive service. The archive could also then send the images via the network to your mobile, ready to upload back onto your device. It was at this point that Anne, who had been smiling but clearly holding back, leapt into the conversation. The point is that different people can share their experiences in different ways. At its most basic, the stone is itself a beautiful object that reminds you of somewhere or someone. We're anticipating a huge number of variants in cosmetic coverings, by the way. It's a memento of itself that can be carried with you, placed on a shelf, or even the bottom of a drawer. She rolled up her sleeves, settling in. Although not a selling point to mobile telecoms, Mary, who's 83, really liked the idea that it kept the same images for her for potentially years. And she liked the idea that when her grandchildren visited, they could all send new images to the stone for her. She called it a wishing stone, which was grand. If the industry could get its act together and actually design a phone for her with large enough buttons, she would love to receive pictures and use the stone to keep them in a safe place. It could be a whole new market, you never know. She coughed, asked for some water, and Gillian hastily got up and sorted out a large jug and glasses for everyone. The wonderful part is the kinetic memory. which means that the images fade over time. They decay, she continued. And I have suggested to Simon that the images do literally fade to black over time. But at least the thing needs no stupid, bulky power block. It's more like a wind-up device, really. You pick it up, and you move it in your own special way, and the images come to life. Just like a snow globe, interjected George, rolling her eyes. After the memento, Anne continued, then you have communities of people, families and friends, wanting to exchange memories and pictures. Amber said she would quite like to have two balls, one for her friends and one for her family, which she could keep updated and then take with her when she was away. For her, these were portable photo frames. An American tourist in Kirkwall was telling me that she was desperate to buy something to remind her of being inside the cathedral, but the postcards were not enough. I'm suggesting that we set up a dummy business with a little kiosk in our foyer for tourists to buy a professionally created experience that's sent directly to their own camera stone, or even to buy a special stone for the cathedral experience in some red sandstone equivalent. Actually, make that the Ring of Brogge. Our industry friends might actually get there during their workshop and see it for themselves. Anne was in full flow now, moving her hands back and forth in small, excited motions. For people like Amber, who send texts and pictures already, it's easy to imagine sending experiences too. There's probably a specialist corporate market for visual services like an ambitious real estate agent who creates a tour-like family home sales ad, but they're really a side issue. Oh, and I hate to be obvious, but the real gossips and memory keepers generally are at home, not in the office. So jewellery and ornamentation are definitely the way forward. It's got to look good on the bedroom table, not on top of the DVD player. Right. She paused in her flow to take a sip of water, smiled at everyone. Okay. Nods all round. Simon was busily scribbling, although I was fairly certain none of this was new to him. Okay, so you don't buy a camera stone from a camera shop, then? Or at least, that's not the only place. You see them in the glass cabinets of the department store, by the watches and the chiffon scarves, with an assistant who takes them out gently for you to touch and admire. You buy them from a display case in Boots. If they're in a phone shop, then they're by the window, tantalising, with a brochure like a glossy house and home magazine for you to take away. But in all those places, you can preload them with images, with an experience, wedding photos, party photos. They're the ideal gift, an ornament, a memory. She looked around again, but everyone, including myself, was enwrapped. So aside from close family and friends, sending these images and movies over the mobile network, there's also the possibility for third parties to help connect up other people. The Bebo and MySpace phenomena. Either from your mobile or via the internet, these organisations offer an archive facility for worlds and a way to view and send worlds to other people you either invite in or with similar interests. That's a rather hard-sell approach from you, Anne, commented George, surprised. Oh, I know, it's just the industry icing. The part I really love is the possibility of bringing moments to those who cannot be there. So, like our own Maze Howe webcam that shows the midwinter sunset, using these stones you could capture those moments of light suffusing the monument and bottle them, encase them in stone, literally. Or a ring around the moon, or a rare bird taking wing, or a sunrise experienced by someone separated from their partner. Even imaginary places inscribed in abstract paintings, emotional yet unreal. She trailed off. Everyone sat still, dreaming. So, we all love it. Will they love it? Asked George. It's got no radio, remarked Simon. He was looking unexpectedly glum, white shards of spiked hair almost drooping with his uncharacteristically downtrodden mood. I know what the industry's like. They're going to see it as an accessory, which will be its death knell, he said. Only if they saw themselves as just to mobile telecoms, rejected Gillian, voice edged with pragmatism. But some of the people we want to invite this winter regard themselves as part of the video and media industry. If they're making camera-based devices, then they are looking for a camera-based device that's something aspirational to head towards, without being weird and wonderful. It's a Bluetooth-enabled digital camera and photo frame in one, said Zhu Yin, calm, hands hidden beneath the table. I like the idea of a PC monitor as a picture frame on the wall. It's that immediacy. Yes, well, I like the picture frame idea as well, added Richard. It's a renewable keepsake at best, said Simon. George, lounging in cushions in a large chair by the fire, shook her head, leaning forward towards the others around the table. Oh, come on, I think you're being a little harsh. I think it has much more beauty and aesthetic quality than the usual gadgetry and digital doodahs these companies usually churn out. I suggest we let them see it in action, suggested Anne. I'll ask Mary and Amber to come in as potential users, one older, one younger. They're both opinionated and articulate, and have been helping me no end for the last couple of weeks. They can sit down with our visitors and just say what they think about the idea, how they imagine it being part of their lives. It's not perfect, after all. It's only a wee concept. We could ask Mary and Amber to subscribe as the first users of the online archive. I could mock it all up using a few cameras and some of their own photos, said Simon. We could get some of the images sent to their own mobile phones, and hey presto, a whole service. Simon was definitely cheering up. I'll do the images of the sales environments, added Zhu Yin. We can take the models and photograph them in various shops around Kirkwall, a tourist place, jewellers, department store, phone shop, electrical store. I can also take some photographs of the models in people's houses. Well, it sounds like an excellent performance to me, said Richard. I think we should put the dumb model in the cafe out front, then leave them waiting in there for a while. Hopefully they'll pick it up. Julian was being devious. Lab rats, smiled Anne, winking at me. Julian picked up the quartz-like camera stone and squinted through each eyepiece, frowned. I can't see anything, she complained. Simon held out his hand, took the stone for a moment, then hesitated, cocked his white spikes to one side and nodded at me. Take it, he instructed. I took hold of the heavily veined stone, rested it in the centre of my palm, felt the warmth of the polishing, its unexpected lightness, as though it were some smooth pumice, and the brief pressure of the glazed lump of an eyepiece upon which it rested. Now, gently roll it in your hands like you might roll a piece of clay, said Simon. I did as he suggested, palm to palm, rolling the stone over and over as if I were warming it. A magical act, making it into a new shape. As the glassy-eyed camera stone turned and turned again within my palms, it seemed to be an opaque crystal ball, a scrying glass through which not the future, but the past, memories, moments, and landscapes might dissolve into view. Inside this stone, visions of experience, of friends won and lost, could be held and revealed through my moving hands. If I understood Simon, different movements could conjure different images, different memories. After a brief moment, Simon nodded. That should do it. Presumably referring to the kinetic powering that the device required. I stopped and held the stone up, looked through one of its eyepieces. Inside was a series of portraits of a rather sparkling elderly lady, knitting needles at the ready, sitting in a low-beamed room with a wide window looking straight out across a harbour. Each image was focused on the woman from all of the five directions, left, right, front, back, and above, so that it seemed as if she were condensed, solidified into the very stone itself. had rubbed the stone and it had come to life like a magic lamp. Inside this magical world was a genie, this woman knitting. I passed the camera stone to Gillian sitting next to me, who peered in and suddenly laughed. "It's George's mother," whispered Gillian. "Oh, no," George had overheard, and Gillian passed the stone over to her. George bent her head to look, then gave a shriek of laughter. "Oh, wow, that's just fabulous." She continued to laugh, tears beginning to gather. "If they don't love it now, they never will," murmured Gillian. All that remained was for Sand 14 to persuade the industry to visit, a by no means straightforward proposition. How would they react to this archaeologically inspired version of their desires? Or would everyone at Sand 14 have to condense all their passion and love for this ball of stone that was not stone into a package of sketches, images, and presentation slides? I would have to wait and see.